Good morning. So we do have a number of folks out. We've got a number of folks that were out at the wedding of Leslie Simmons and Will Beatty yesterday. Among the folks, Dustin and Rebecca and Joel and Lisa and Russ and Peggy, and just a number of folks out. But appreciate you being here. Just as I think about lessons that I've shared over time, it's one of those questions I have. So many lessons that I have touch on food, and I don't know if it's just because I'm hungry when I'm working on the lesson or just partial that way or what, but start this morning's lesson with another food situation that comes up of what happens in your house when one of those events occurs, when food gets dropped on the floor. Now, Miss Jane's house would be safe to eat because her floors are so clean. Not necessarily that way in every house. It's just interesting. So often when you have a piece of bread, a piece of toast with something on it, and it falls, it's not the unbuttered or undoctored side that hits the floor first. It's the side with the jam on it, it seems like. And that's the way it happens for me. For me as well, you may have a five-second rule in your house that says, okay, if it's only been on the floor for 5 seconds or less, it's safe to grab and eat. But you may also have a dog around. If you've got a two-second dog, the five-second rule doesn't really count, does it? It's as if your dog sometimes can sense that's about to happen and about to come. Herd and I always like flow charts. We like to think things through. And I ran across a flow chart for about dealing with food that's dropped. And it starts with the most important question of all. And the most important question isn't necessarily how clean the floor is. The most important question is, did anybody see me do it? And after that, if you go down that left side, you deal with the questions of, was it sticky? Are you really hungry? Did the cat or dog lick it? And you get to that question of, is it bacon? And if it's bacon, the rules, you always eat it. But if somebody did see it, you think about, well, was it something really special, something really important? Then you make your decisions based on that. But you're thinking about, well, how much did it get impacted? How much did it get changed? How much difference happened to it? How much contaminant may be there? And it gets to this question that sometimes you get food that has something in it that's not supposed to be there. And it's that question of, well, how much is really there? Is it enough to bother me? When years ago, I think it was the first time I ever went on the Appalachian Trail as I was a Boy Scout at that time. And the scoutmaster had said you needed to take energy food of some kind. They recommended taking honey. And I only had honey. I had a glass jar full of honey. I didn't want to carry a glass jar. I knew I could get a plastic bottle somewhere along the way, and I waited till it was too late on. And on the trip to go get on the Appalachian Trail, stopped in a little market, and I went in looking for something that'd be a squeeze bottle, and the only squeeze bottle I could find was dishwashing soap. So, yeah, you know what happens. I went in the restroom, and I poured out the soap, and I washed it out, and I was pretty sure that I really washed it out. Poured my honey in that, and that's what I carried in my backpack, and it did the job. It didn't break. It was lightweight overall, but the first taste of honey, yeah, it had that taste. It had that soapy taste. I could not, you know, just could not ever forget what had been in there before, because it had touched it and made a difference. And you get food and you think about, how much does it take to really contaminate it? If it's one part in 100, maybe you don't want to do it. A part in 1,000, it might be a little bit better. A part in 1,000,000 shouldn't matter much, but the Food and Drug Administration has their guidelines for contaminants in food, and it's not something you want to know about, I think. That by the Food and Drug Administration rules, if you have 100 grams of peanut butter, it's fine to have up to 30 fragments of bugs in it in 100 grams. And they list other things that can be in 100 grams of peanut butter that I won't mention right now. But it's just, it makes you stop and think. You really want it to be a very small amount, enough that it's not going to make a difference. And that last number, one part in 320 million, it's one of those a little bit odd kind of numbers, but it has relevance to the lesson today. That 0.00003% or 0.003% really doesn't seem like much. But that number is the population of the United States. And that one part in 320 or 327 million, whatever the current number is, that's us in this population of this nation. That's how much we are, what fraction we are of this nation. You think about all the people that are out there, the masses, and I'm not a fan of being in crowds, lots of reasons perhaps, but you think about us being just one part in 300-something million folks, and well, Satan tries to tell us we can't make any difference in that circumstance. We are such a small part of the community or of the world that we really can't have an impact. I think if the soap in that jar of honey was only one part in 320 million, I might have never tasted it. Wouldn't have made a difference. But the Bible deals with that question about what difference one person in that kind of number can make. In fact, the Bible has got so many examples where one person in a crowd, one person in a huge number, made an amazing difference. And it's just important for us to think of and important for us to recognize that. We'll look quickly at a couple of examples from God's Word because it just shows the power of what can happen when God is working with an individual in whatever circumstance that you're in. The one that always comes to mind to me first is over in 1 Kings chapter 18. It's the story of Elijah and the prophets of Baal and how Elijah lived in a time that was tough. Two chapters before in 1 Kings 16, we read that the king of that time, Ahab, was one of the most wicked kings that had ever lived. There had been none lived before him that was that bad. And his wife, Queen Jezebel, and he set up altars to different idols throughout the land. They were idol worshipers, and they went beyond just worshiping idols themselves. They went to the point of seeking out and killing God's prophets. So God's prophets, many of them were in hiding in the land because of what the king and queen were doing. And Elijah, one man in a nation that is turning against God, in a nation whose leadership are putting to death people like him, Elijah comes forward and challenges them and challenges the adulterous priest. Elijah talked about at the table of Jezebel, there were 450 prophets of Baal and 400 prophets of Asherah, these idols that were eating there with the king and queen. So one man versus the leaders, one man versus these 450 prophets, one man that stands alone. And when he stands up, it's not like there are 15 or 20 or 100 other folks that come. Yeah, I'm with him. He's all by himself. He, in this challenge, says, we've got a couple of bulls here. You pick the one you want. You build an altar to Baal, and you call on him and have him, if he's real, send down fire from heaven and consume this offering to him. And the prophets of Baal, they built their altar, and they started crying out to this false god, and they cried and cried, and nothing happened. And they started cutting themselves and crying out in more extreme ways, and nothing happened. And the whole day went through with no one answering. There's a passage in 1 Kings 18, verse 29, that it's one of those haunting passages. You imagine all of these folks crying out to their false god that they had believed had some substance. And the verse says, but there was no response. No one answered, and no one paid attention. because there was nothing there. And then it picks up with Elijah. Elijah, at the end of, towards the end of the day, says to the people, "Come here to me." And they came to him, and he repaired the temple of the Lord, which was in ruins. Elijah, he took 12 stones, one for every one of the tribes of Israel. He was just trying to help folks recognize and realize that this God that he's worshiping and talking about isn't new to the scene. It's part of the heritage and history of the people. He rebuilt the altar with the 12 stones. And then he said, "Your name shall be Israel." That the Lord said, "Your name will be Israel." With the stones, he built an altar in the name of the Lord, and he dug a trench around it large enough to hold 2 seahs of seed. He arranged the wood, cut the bull in pieces, and laid it in the altar. And then he asked them to start filling these large jars with water and pouring it over the wood and pouring it over the sacrifice until it ran down deep enough to fill up the trench. I think about what he was doing, and it almost seems like he's working against God. He's about to call on God to bring down this fire from heaven, and he's not helping. It's hard enough sometimes to get a campfire lit, much less one with anything damp, but this stuff is soaking wet. And I think of times that I was about to take a test, and sometimes in Dr. Curse's math class, and I needed to study before them. And if I'd really studied before them, which happened on occasion, but if I'd really studied before them and then prayed about it, I felt like I was pretty well prepared. But if I didn't study a lick and went in and just prayed, hadn't done what I could do in my own power, I felt like I was not honoring God with asking him to fill in for what I should have done to start with. It's like Elijah is not only not helping, but he's hurting God in setting up this way. But when you think further, he was helping God. He wanted there to be absolutely no doubt when God acted that it was God at work. He wanted the folks to know there wasn't a smoldering ember in that piece of wood. There wasn't anything shady going on, that this was going to be a real challenge. We read, at the time of the sacrifice, Elijah stepped forward, and this is the prayer he prayed. "O Lord, God of Abraham and Isaac and Israel," he goes back to remind them, this is the God of our nation, the God of eternity, the God who's been there through time. He says, "God of Abraham and Isaac and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant and have done these things at your command. Answer me, O Lord, answer me so that these people will know you, that you, O Lord, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again." He prayed that prayer, and then the fire came down, consumed not only the sacrifice, it consumed the wood that was soaked with water. It licked up the water that was in the ditch, consumed the stones that were there as well. There was nothing left, nothing left. And the people saw that and fell prostrate and said, "The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God." Start of the day, it's a different story going on. Start of the day, the leaders, 450 prophets of Baal, all these folks are thinking, that God, old news, can't really do anything. One man stands up and changes the mind of the whole country. In James chapter 5, when James is talking about the power of prayer, he says, "The effectual and fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much." And when James says that, he points back to Elijah as being the example of that. It was one man standing before a nation. We see other examples of one person making a difference. The story of David that you remember, when David was just a shepherd and he went to visit his brothers that were soldiers. His brothers were in the Israelite army, and they were at a standstill in a valley facing the Philistine armies. One army on one side, one army on the other. We read for 40 days there was a huge warrior, Philistine giant named Goliath, that came out and challenged the Israelites and said, "Hey, pick whoever you want. send them out to fight me. If whoever you send out wins, we will all be your servants. And every day when he came out, the Israelites, these trained soldiers and warriors, they just trembled. They were scared to death of what Goliath could do. But there was a shepherd boy. There's a shepherd boy that came on the scene. David showed up and he asked what was going on and he heard the story. And he thought about how God had been with him when he was protecting his sheep. And when a lion came or when a bear came, that God gave him victory. And he started talking about it. King called him in and said, "What is this you're saying?" And he was willing to stand before Goliath. And the king, you know, you have to puzzle about this. Whoever stands against Goliath, if he loses, all of Israel's going to be in bondage to this other nation. But there's something about David and something about his faith and his confidence that he is able to do what no other warrior was doing at that time. He convinces the king, "Send me." And when the king tries to put armor on him, he says, "No." He's not taking that armor. He's not taking a sword. He's not taking a javelin. And he goes out and stands before him. And David says to the Philistine, "You come against me with sword and spear and javelin, but I came to come to you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel." That's all it took. That is all it took. He didn't need a knight's armor. He didn't need a great sword from a smith. He just needed God on his side, and he was able to stand where no one else had stood. And he, after saying that he was standing with God on his side, he took that stone and took that sling, and with folks thinking, "What in the world is going on?" he slew Goliath, and he won the victory for Israel. One little boy, one shepherd boy, able to stand against him, triumphing over the Philistine. You see the example of Esther standing up for a people. She was a Jewish young maiden who was picked by the king to be the queen, by King Xerxes. There was someone in the land named Haman, an evil man, a leader in the king's court who had set out to kill all of the people of Esther's nationality, all the Jews, and he made arrangements for it. Esther appears to not have been known in terms of her nationality. She could have sat quietly by and let herself be safe in the king's court. But her uncle Mordecai came to her and said, "You're in this position. You need to speak up. You need to intervene for the Jews." And that passage that we read about in the book of Esther, as Mordecai said those words to her, "And who knows, but God put you here for such a time as this," just rings so true that it's true in our lives. We find ourselves in circumstances and situations where it seems like we're alone, seems like we're outnumbered. So many others on the opposite side. Let the words of Mordecai echo in your ears in those circumstances. "Who knows, but God has put us there for such a time as that." She spoke up. She spoke up, went before the king, and ended up saving her people. Last one is just thinking about Daniel versus the followers of King Darius. Daniel was one of three senior leaders in that kingdom before that king, and he still worshiped the God of Israel. His peers didn't like him. His peers were jealous of him, and they sought to oust him. They persuaded the king to put in place this rule that said anybody that prays to anyone but you, the king, should be executed. And we read about Daniel. Daniel prayed to God regularly. And in this circumstance, the Bible says those words, "Now when Daniel learned that the decree had been published," you know, it wasn't a question of him not knowing. When he knew that that was the rule, he went to his house just like always. He opened the windows just like always. He prayed just like it was his normal practice. He stood there. And the consequences, he was thrown into the lion's den. He was to be executed. God was with him. God was with him, saved his life. And then, as the king saw him saved by the power of a miraculous God, the king proclaimed throughout the land that this is the God we're going to serve. Not the ones of these advisors that said he needed to be put to death, but this is the God. Just throughout the Bible, our example after example of one person standing up in all kinds of circumstances, men and women, young and old, and making a difference when they know that they're in the right, when they know that God is on their side. I keep being reminded of that story of the starfish on the seashore, about the little boy who's seen the tide gone out, and he sees these starfish there, and he's walking down the beach, and he's throwing starfish back in the ocean. And a man sees him and asks what he's doing. And the boy said, "Well, I'm saving the starfish." And the man says, "But look, there are miles of beach. There are hundreds or thousands of these things. You can never take care of all of that." And he doesn't answer right away, but he takes another starfish and throws it in the ocean. And he says, "I made a difference for that one. I made a difference for that one." We find ourselves in that circumstance at times, that we may not be in the place where we're going to stand before an entire nation and change the course of history, as some of those we saw. But we are put in places where we can speak up. We're put in places where we can act. We're put in places where we can be a voice or an example of someone who's a servant of God. And it can be just sitting around the dinner table as a conversation could be helped and benefited by recognizing God's goodness and bringing that up. It can be as we're in a difficult situation at work and folks are struggling, and just the reminder that we could do a lot of things here, but the right thing to do, the honest thing to do, the thing that God would have us do, that's this. Or I'm not going to go down that path because I'm a follower of God and I can't do that. In sports, whether we're a team player or watching a team, sometimes we can get so wrapped up in that. And it's just taking the time sometimes to remember that it's not about winning at all cost. There are things more important than the outcome of the games that we're involved in. And when we see one of God's children in need, we will never eliminate poverty in this world. The Bible tells us the poor will always be with us, but we can make a difference for that one. We can have an impact on lives that we come into contact with. And so the lesson this morning is just a lesson that says, when Satan tries to tell us that we can't make a difference, that we're outnumbered, that the little we do will never be noticed, never have impact, know that God is able, through broken vessels like us, to make an impact. Maybe with a small group, it may be at work, it may be with a bigger group. But the choice that we've got to choose is just that choice of remembering, perhaps God put us here for such a time as this. We need to act, and once we act, we let God work out the rest of it, because He's able. He's able. This morning, if you've wondered what God has in store for you in your life, if you're wondering what you need to do in order to honor Him, the first step in honoring Him, the first step of making impact, is impacting your own life with that decision to live for Him, that decision to turn your life over to Him, to come in obedience and confession and prayer. If you're subject in any way to the Lord's invitation, we invite you to come as we stand and sing.
Oh, Lord, down with sorrow, oh, eyes that long for sight, there's gladness in believing in Jesus.